Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now, Season 3. I'm your host, Keith Mavidigan Sr. Today I'm talking with Kimball Grandin, a autism spokesperson, author, academic, and animal behavioralist. Kimball, welcome to the show.
It's really good to be here today.
Thank you very much. So for the few people listening who may not know who you are, can you introduce yourself and tell us what set you on your professional path?
Well, I am now a professor of animal science at Colorado State University, but I had no speech until age 4. I had very severe autistic symptoms at age 2 and 3, rocking, screaming, tantrums. I was very lucky to get into a very good early educational class with a really wonderful speech therapist. That was really important. And I had a lot of good teachers that helped me. And I want to give credit to my mother and the other good teachers who worked with me, getting me to do new things, encouraging my ability in art. I had a wonderful third grade teacher. And when I was 8 years old, I did not know how to read. And my teacher was very concerned about this. So the mother taught me to read at home with phonics. And we got a fun book, The Wizard of Oz, a really fun book for my generation. And mother taught me the sounds. I already knew my ABC song, which has about half the sounds. And she'd read a page and then she'd stop in an interesting part and have me read more and more, sounding out my words. And I very quickly went from no reading to sixth grade level reading. I had a lot of problems in high school, bullied, teased, ended up getting kicked out of high school in ninth grade for throwing a book at a girl who was bullying me. But I had some other really good teachers. My science teacher got me interested in studying. I just want to give credit to all the good teachers that I had.
Thank you. In your memoir, Thinking in Pictures, you talk a lot about autism and medicine, Chapter 6, Believer in Biochemistry. You were very forthcoming that you are on an antidepressant. Why do people with autism often require lower doses for effective treatment?
Well, there's a difference between using an antidepressant to treat anxiety, which was my problem, and to treat depression. And the label has the doses for depression, but for anxiety, you often need much lower doses. And a very common mistake is made, and parents have told this to me over and over again. My child or teenager did really well on a low dose. We doubled the dose and he could not sleep and got agitated. Now, I started taking this medication in my early 30s. I had panic attacks that worsened all through my 20s, got worse and worse. Colitis attacks that would not stop. And I had read an article, this would be back in the 70s, in Psychology Today called The Promise of Biological Psychiatry. And then I went over to the library using skills I'd been taught by my science teacher to look up medical articles. And I looked through the symptoms and I had like 8 out of 10 of them. But I resisted the idea of taking a medication, so I laid that article aside. And then I had a very stressful eye surgery, and that really got me stressed out. So I pulled the article out, and I started taking a low dose of an old-fashioned drug called imipramine. This is my book, Thinking in Pictures, where I discuss this. Even though that information is 25 years old, it is still accurate. The medications have not change. They're still using the same medications. Now, there's way too many medications given out to young children, and especially more medications with more severe side effects, such as the atypical antipsychotics. There's too much of that given out. But for teenagers and adults on the spectrum, there's a segment of them that has extremely high anxiety. Not everybody, just a segment. And I was one of those individuals, really, really high anxiety. And it's biology. A brain scan showed that my fear center was bigger than normal. And the medication really helped me. I've been on it now for 40 years, and I plan to keep taking it. I have seen a low dose of Prozac help people, and they got stable. And I've also seen a disaster when they went off the medication. Really bad mess.
So what would you say to someone with autism who struggled with the idea of being medicated?
Well, I struggled with that some, and I discuss it in here because when I first found the article, after I read the article in Psychology Today, that I went over to the library and I found the articles. I laid them aside for 2 years. I did struggle some with the idea of taking medication. But then I had to have a very scary eye surgery, plastic surgery, conscious needles and stuff coming down to my eye. And that got me really stressed out, really stressed out. And then I realized if I don't take the medication, I'm going to really be in trouble. And the colitis was getting worse and worse and worse and worse. That's why I was eating yogurt and Jell-O. And when I went on the medication, within a week or so, the colitis cleared up. And that's why the chapter is called A Believer in Biochemistry. When medications work, it's often just one thing sometimes that works. And that's when I realized that the anxiety was biology. I want to emphasize, not every autistic person has this severe anxiety. But I was one of those. And then after I went on the medication for a while, I got to thinking, well, I guess this is how so-called normal people feel. But it was sort of being a constant state of fear all the time, constantly fearful. The littlest thing, my heart would pound. I'd hear some noise in the middle of the night, wake up with my heart pounding. Sometimes I had difficulty swallowing. And it worked. And I know some other people where it's worked. And I know some people that had bipolar and they might get on lithium or some other medicine. And it worked. All I can say is if you're stable, you're taking a low dose, the only side effect I have is I have to drink a lot of water. It's about the only side effect I have. And I made the mistake too of going, oh, I can stop taking this. Then I found out that I could not. But I have seen people like they were stable on lithium. They went off the medication. And then one of the problems is sometimes the brain gets in trouble when they go off the medication and it doesn't work as well when they go back on it. I don't even know if I'd be alive today if I hadn't gone on the medication. My health in my early 30s was so bad. I probably would have had to have surgery to have half my innards taken out. The colitis got so bad. And the thing that was amazing is the colitis cleared up within 2 weeks after I went on the medication. And now I just have little tiny bits of colitis.
Wow. So in your new book, which came out last year, Visual Thinking, you talk a lot about the disability mindset. And in your opinion, is it good or bad? And what is your opinion on special education?
Well, we need to look at ages. Let's start with three-year-olds. I was in a very good program at age three, and I'm a very big believer in early education. And I know there's been a lot of controversy about different teaching methods. I'm going to just say little three-year-olds that are not talking need about 20 hours a week with an effective teacher. And what I've observed is some teachers have the ability to work with these children and some don't. So this is what you should get from a program for little children. Working on speech. Other thing that was worked on with me is how to wait and take turns at games. They teach you to inhibit a response. And there was no emphasis on eye contact. That was not emphasized. It was speech, turn taking, and then skills. Hair brushing, putting your coat on, using utensils. And then the fourth thing is the child should like going to therapy. You should be getting progress and the child should like going to therapy. Now, about a disability mindset, one of the big problems I'm seeing is I'm seeing fully verbal teenagers that are doing very well in school, but they're not learning life skills. They're not learning things that I learned in elementary school, shopping, ordering food in restaurants, bank account, laundry, learning how to save money, just basic life skills like that. We need to be teaching those things. And then how about work skills? Sudden transitions are really bad for people on the autism spectrum. So we need to start teaching work skills young, and that's different than academic skills. Maybe at age 11, volunteer jobs, farmer's market, a nursing home, where you're walking somebody else's dog, where somebody outside the family is the boss. And then as soon as they're legal, a job maybe at the grocery store or some other job I want to avoid. These are the jobs I want to avoid. Rapid multitasking jobs. McDonald's takeout window, no. Other thing is, I cannot remember long strings of verbal instruction. Any task that requires sequence, let me write it down in a pilot's checklist. That's kind of my external working memory. But the problem, I think some of the problem with the disability mindset in autism is they've changed the diagnosis. So autism's going from Einstein, no speech until age three, he'd be in an autism program today, to somebody who's much more severe and may have a whole lot of other medical issues, epilepsy on top of autism, where autism is not the only diagnosis. And originally, for an autism diagnosis, you had to have speech delay. That's what I had. Then there was the Asperger's, socially awkward, no speech delay. Then in 2013, 10 years ago, all of that was merged together. I think that was a big mistake. Because if a person is diagnosed with ADHD or dyslexia, that's much more narrow. Reading difficulties, attention difficulties. But now you have this autism spectrum that's so broad. And I'm a visual thinker. So I'm like, I thought it was a big mistake combining all of those things together.
So following up on what you just said, the spectrum has gotten incredibly broad.
Yes, that's right.
And I know that before it was called autism, it was called Asperger's. Is there any difference between the two disorders?
Well, the difference was autism originally, the child had to have speech delay. You had to have delayed speech to be called autism, where to be called Asperger's, no speech delay. Asperger's has no obvious speech delay, but then autistic symptoms. That was the main difference. And then they merged them all together. So now you've got somebody like Einstein or somebody who's programming computers for a tech company with the same label as somebody that might even have to have other neurological difficulties on top of the autism.
Thank you for clearing that up. So let's get more into your new book, Visual Thinking.
Yes, right here. Well, in visual thinking, I talk about three different kinds of ways that people think, and they have different abilities. I'm an object visualizer. everything I think about is a photographic picture. And if you watch the HBO movie, that shows exactly how I think in pictures. Now, another kind of thinker is the visual spatial. This person thinks in patterns. I think in photo-like pictures. The visual spatial thinks in patterns. This is your mathematical mind. Think chemistry, physics, computer programming. And then you have verbal thinkers. And a lot of educators are highly verbal thinkers. They think in words. Now, I thought everybody thought in pictures until I was in my late 30s. And that's when I learned that not everybody thinks in pictures. And a lot of people are mixtures. So let's look at kinds of jobs that some of these different thinkers might be good at. For my kind of mind, object visualizer, it's going to be art, photography, working with animals, and mechanical devices, fixing cars. Art and mechanics kind of go together. Then you have the visual spatial. It's going to be mathematics, music, chemistry, higher math. And word thinkers, of course, are good with words. And I'm very interested in helping people get into satisfying careers, because one of the things that's made my life worthwhile and made interesting is having an interesting career. That's been extremely important to me. And I want to help other individuals to get into interesting careers. Because when I was out working on equipment in the meatpacking plants, I worked with a lot of skilled metal workers that were inventing equipment. And some of them had barely graduated from high school. And about 20% of the people I worked with today would either be autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD.
So are all people with autism by default visual thinkers?
No, they're not. That was a mistake I made. When I wrote Thinking in Pictures 26 years ago, I made the mistake of thinking that everybody was a visual thinker. That's wrong. Only a portion of the people on the autism spectrum are visual thinkers. Then the other type of thinker is the mathematical thinker. They think in patterns. And then there are some autistic people that think in words. They often are good at foreign languages. They like facts, like sports statistics, historical things. They love facts. But what tends to happen in autism is you're less likely to have a mixture of the different kinds of thinking. Much, much less likely. A lot of so-called normal people are more likely to be a mixture. Where if an autistic person, you might get an extreme object visualizer like me, who's good at art, mechanics, photography, and animals, or an extreme mathematician, physicist, computer programmer, music, chemistry, or then you have a verbal thinker. They tend to be more extreme, where so-called normal people, you tend to get a lot more mixtures of the different kinds of thinking. And this is discussed in my book, Visual Thinking. And I discuss how we get into good careers using these skills. I do a lot of talks to big corporations, and I tell them that you need the skills of people with autism to do things like fix elevators, for example, for my kind of mind.
So following up on what you just said, what work environment would be ideal for people with autism?
Well, there can be some sensory issues. I'd rather work on I'll talk about the things I not want to have them in. A rapid multitasking environment. This would be a bad job, a McDonald's takeout window. Good jobs, computer programmer. They can sit at their desk and do the computer programming. I could sit and do my design drawings. In fact, right here's some of my drawings for livestock. I could do my drawings. And the way I sold the jobs was to show people my drawings. That's how I sold the jobs. I showed off my portfolio. Writing jobs, There's a lot of things like that. And then there's some jobs where you have to, you know, there's a lot of people of my kind of mind good at skilled trades. But the thing that we have to avoid is that long strings of verbal information. There was a very sad story where an autistic man was fired from two electrician apprenticeships because the boss would go, yak, 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 light fixture, yak, 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 dimmer switch. And the autistic person couldn't remember the things he was supposed to install that day. If they had taken 2 minutes to make a list, I call it a pilot's checklist, make a list with some bullet points of the things to install that day, they would have had the job. That's something that I would do. I would write down the electrical devices I had to install that day. And if the boss didn't have time for that, I'd go, pilots need a checklist. I need one too. And I want to let everybody know pilots are required to use a checklist for every single flight.
So you open visual thinking by reflecting on the fact that a lot of shop classes and other trade classes have almost virtually disappeared from American schooling, although in Arizona, where I am, they still teach some, but for the vast majority, the classes you took when you were in school aren't really favored anymore.
Well, the problem is we're going to need these skills. In my book, Visual Thinking, I discuss very severe problems with skill loss because we took skilled trades out. The U.S. no longer makes the state-of-the-art electronic chip-making machine. We don't make that. It comes from Holland. We no longer make poultry processing equipment, pork processing equipment, a lot of specialized electrical stuff. And this goes back to taking skilled trades classes out. You see that, and the kind of people who are good at these things are people like me. I was on a Zoom call real recently with a high school class, and I talked about the different kinds of thinkers, the visual thinkers like me, and the mathematical thinkers and the word thinkers. And this girl came up to the computer because they had to go to the computer to answer the questions. And she says, my guidance counselor told me not to take any VoTech classes. Well, I'll tell you, these are going to be the things where the jobs will not be replaced by computers. Somebody's got to fix elevators. Somebody's got to fix airplanes and trains and cars. These jobs will not get replaced by computers.
VoTech is vocational, correct?
That's right. VoTech, that's vocational. Now, I want to emphasize the difference between high-end skilled trades, like an electrician, plumber, a metal fabricator who can invent mechanical devices. These are the people I worked with. They invented all kinds of mechanical devices. This is not laying floor tiles or putting up roofing materials. That's just work. I'm talking about the types of skilled trades that require real visual intelligence.
So there's a big trend on social media sites like TikTok where people produce content like, if you do such and such, you may be autistic. Do you think self-diagnosing is helpful or harmful?
Well, there's a lot of older adults that when they discover they're autistic, they often discover they're autistic when their children get diagnosed. In fact, I've got this book here, Different Not Less, and these are 18 people, older people diagnosed later in life, describing their experiences, and they found that that gave them insight into problems with relationships. After all, an autism diagnosis is just a behavioral profile. There's no lab test or X-ray for diagnosing autism. And I had a lady come up to me at the Denver airport one time, and she said my book, Thinking in Pictures, helped her understand her engineer husband, who was probably on the spectrum, and that it saved their marriage. Because then she understood that the way he thinks and feels is different. But so I think that that can be very helpful. Most older people that get diagnosed later in life feel a sense of relief. That's a good thing. But the other thing I'm concerned about is teenagers and young adults, especially fully verbal ones, not learning any life skills. I've talked to parents and I say, has your 16-year-old ever just gone into a store by themselves and bought something and talked to the store staff? No, that's a problem.
So you mentioned the HBO movie at the beginning of the episode, and I just watched it last night. It is incredible. The last half an hour had me in tears. It was just so moving. I want to know your thoughts and favorite parts from the movie, and what was it like meeting Claire Danes, the actress that portrayed you?
Well, let's talk about some of the things I really liked and the things that were really accurate. The first thing is it showed how my visual thinking works. It showed exactly how my mind works. It also showed projects that I actually did. And that's another thing I really liked about it. And Claire Danes, she managed to become me. We gave her old tapes, old VHS tapes, oldest ones I could find. And she played those over and over and over again. And she sort of became me. I remember listening to an interview on the radio in the car, and they were interviewing me, and then Claire Danes would talk in the movie, and I almost mixed them up.
How would you like watching yourself in another body?
Well, it was, I remember going to they had a private showing at the HBO office, and I just was there with the HBO producers in a little theater they had watching it. And it was like going into a really strange 60s and 70s time machine. That's what it felt like.
And so how accurate was it beyond the portraying your visual thinking?
Well, a movie, they have to change things to fit a two-hour movie. But I really liked the fact that, my main characters, my mother, Anne at the ranch, was shown really nicely. And Mr. Carlock got an honorary doctorate. He was Mr. Carlock, and they made him Dr. Carlock. And I go, yeah, we'll let him have an honorary doctorate. He deserves it.
Why do you think neurotypical people believe that people with autism are geniuses or savants and lack empathy?
Well, most
why had those assumptions persisted over years and years?
Well, now you've asked me too many questions, and I've lost my train of thought. This is where I don't do well with long-term the verbal thinking, but on empathy, I have a lot of empathy for physical hardship. When I see wrecked houses and people looking at that, I'm going, oh, that's just horrible. I remember seeing like wrecked apartment buildings with people standing in broken apartments. I feel a lot of empathy for that. And I've forgotten the other question. You see, this is where I have almost no working memory.
So, sorry about that. So why do you think that neurotypical people assume that people with autism are savants.
Oh, okay. Most autistics are not savants. I want to make that very clear. And I am not a savant. And there's a number of autistic people that are extremely intelligent, but that's certainly not the entire spectrum. The other thing I want to talk about is there are individuals that do not speak, and some of these individuals that do not speak can learn to type completely independently. And they describe sensory scrambling. They describe problems with being able to control their movements. And we need to be teaching them to type. Now, one of the big problems with people with, remember I talked about working memory, where I cannot remember long strings of verbal instruction. I need to have a checklist. Any task that has steps in it need a checklist. And so for the person that I'm learning to type, it's not going to work on this desktop that I'm on now because, okay, the keyboard's way, way down below where the picture is. But the print, when I type, is going to appear way up here. Autistic people cannot make that attention shift. So that's why you have to use something like an iPad, because the print appears next to the virtual keyboard. Or you're going to have to put a box up here with the keyboard on it, so the print appears right next to the keyboard. That's one of the secrets to helping them learn how to type. And I knew a teacher, I think her name was Mary Crossley, I'm not sure, that did this like 30 years ago or with a box. And there's some good books written by people that type independently, like Tita Makapatahei, How Can I Talk If My Lips Don't Move? There's a Japanese boy, The Reason I Jump. There's a sequel to The Reason I Jump that I think is a much better book with a lot more insight in it. I would recommend the sequel. I think people that are working with non-speaking individuals need to read these books. Now, I'm not talking about three-year-olds. I'm talking about older children and adults.
So is there a difference between savants and regular geniuses? People who are really intelligent, is there a difference, and what are those differences?
Well, there's some people with autism that are extremely intelligent. Yeah. And there's, you see, there's a whole range, but there's a small amount of them that are savants, you know, like Rain Man. And then there's others that have an extreme, I'm an extreme visual thinker, which makes me really good at things like understanding animals, photography, and mechanical things. And then there's some that are extreme mathematicians, but they're not savants. I have been out to the tech companies, you know, that make computers and other things, and there's many undiagnosed people with autism in those tech companies.
Yeah, you talk a lot about Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Alan Turing, father of modern computing, Einstein, Edison, I believe, titans of their industries, and people who have really reshaped, are shaped how we live and conduct our lives. Knowing that, what would you hope that people who are neurotypical would know about people with autism?
Well, there's some things I talked about, some of the things at work, working memory issues, needing written checklists, avoiding multitasking jobs. But I do a lot of talk to business leaders, and I tell them, you need the skills. You need the skills. Your best elevator mechanic, your best airplane mechanic is not going to interview well. It is likely to be socially awkward. I worked with a lot of these people. Your very best computer people may not interview well. You see, I think it's really important for an autistic person to be able to show off their portfolio. And that's the reason why the way I sold jobs is I showed my drawings to people. And in other words, selling my work. But I make it very plain to business leaders, you need these skills. And I kind of look at it this way. A brain can be more social, emotional, or a brain can be sort of more thinking and cognitive and in what they do. So if you were to take the whole population of the world, half of the population is probably going to move towards the social, emotional, and the other half lean a bit towards the, more towards the interesting thinking and logic. And, you know, there's the mildest ones, autism is probably just a personality variant. You know, when does being kind of nerdy and geeky become, need a label on it? There's no black and white dividing line. It's not like having tuberculosis, where you either have tuberculosis or you do not have tuberculosis. And they can test for it with a lab test. It is a true continuous trait. And I'm basically sort of I am what I do. And I want to see these kids that are different today get up and get into a good career, because that's what gave me a satisfying life, is having an interesting career and where I could actually improve things. I think I've helped improve how cattle and other livestock are treated.
What would you think about people with autism becoming ASL interpreters? Is that a job that they would excel at?
Well, yeah, I mean, be a deaf interpreter, for example?
Yes.
Okay, well, that'd be a great job for them. And they're going to be judged on their work, because some are probably better than others. Yeah, that'd be a great job for somebody on the spectrum. Would not be a great job for me, but it might be a great job for somebody else.
Yeah, there's a difference about being a ASL interpreter, American Sign Language, and a deaf interpreter.
Yeah, I'm a believer in is that we need to take kids and young adults, expose them to lots of different things. I get asked all the time, how did I end up in the cattle industry? I ended up in it because I was exposed to it as a teenager. I did not grow up in it. Too many kids today, they've taken hands-on classes out. They don't use tools. They don't know how to measure things. You know, we need to be putting all those hands-on classes back in. Some schools are doing it now, because you can only get interested in something that you are exposed to. You're not exposed to something, how could you possibly get interested in it? I also suggest to parents, if a child's fixated on cars, then let's do reading with cars. Let's do math with cars. Let's learn how they work. Let's read about the history of cars. You see, I'm taking this interest in cars and I'm broadening it. Parents sometimes and teachers sometimes want to stomp out fixations. What I want to do is broaden them and make them less fixated. When I was a little kid, I would do constant pictures of a single horse head. And mother suggested to me, well, let's do the whole horse. Let's draw the saddle. She took my drawing interest and broadened it.
So how was it going to school in the pre-ADA generation?
Well, I was very lucky that there was a small little local school that I went to, where my mother and the teacher just got together. And then when I got older, I got kicked out of a regular high school. And that was a disaster. And that's where my family did have money to send me to special school. Because a regular school just didn't work. And when I went to the special school, they put me to work cleaning horse stalls. They wanted to make sure I learned how to work, which was really important. Now there's a lot of grandparents of my generation that are autistic, and I've talked to them at meetings. And one of the things that helped them, especially of the Asperger type, where there's no speech delay, they had paper routes at age 11. They learned to work. Also in the 50s, some table manners, shaking hands, learning how to take turns in conversation. That was taught. That was actually taught in the 50s to all children. Now, I was very severe at age 3. So I was the kind of kid that normally got put in an institution. But the more Asperger type, where there's no speech delay, A lot of those had problems with relationships, but I've talked to a bunch of them that had decent jobs of people my age, maybe, you know, 10 years younger. And that's where the more kind of the social skills teaching, like we sit down at dinner and I'd reach across the table to get the mashed potato dish and mother would say, ask your sister to pass it. She'd give me the instruction. Kids were taught this. And I think that's helped some of those grandfathers and grandmothers get those jobs and keep them.
So going back to your memoir again, Thinking in Pictures, chapter 7 is called Dating Data. And I love how you use the analogy of Data on Star Trek, The Next Generation. Very apt entry. What are your thoughts on relationships and people with autism in general?
Well, the way I think relationships often work out the best is when there's a friendship through shared interests. Like when I was in high school, one of the places where I was not bullied was horseback riding. That was a place where I was not bullied. And we need to be working on friends who shared interest. One enterprising teacher started a Star Wars club for an elementary school kid that was being bullied. Other kids joined that. That's an easy thing to do. And it didn't even cost anything. That kind of stuff is easy to do to help get friends who shared interest. Also, I had to learn that I just couldn't go on and on and on talking about my favorite thing just over and over and over and over again to the point where everybody else was bored with it.
If there are any aspiring advocates who are just starting out on their advocacy journey like you did, you have experience, a wealth of experience. What would be your 5 suggestions to the advocates of the next generation?
Well, the first thing, I didn't do any autism advocacy until a little tiny bit in my late 20s. I was out in feed yards designing equipment. And being a woman in the 70s going into the cattle industry was a much bigger barrier than autism, much, much bigger barrier. And most of my problems were with middle management. But I was writing, I was livestock editor for our state farm magazine. And it was, and I had all this, you know, all this work stuff I was doing. Then the advocacy started. And I've told a lot of people that I think they might be a more effective advocate if they, along with the advocacy, had a job that had nothing to do with it. I mean, writing for the magazine, that was one of my first jobs, had nothing to do with autism. There were certain meetings I had to cover, Arizona cattle feeders, the Arizona cattle growers, the Arizona National Stock Show. Those things I had to cover every year. And then I would do some feature stories. And this had nothing to do with autism. And I got respect because I was good at writing articles. And when I covered the cattle feeders meeting, I summarized those speeches accurately. And I got, you know, respect for that. So I started out with work. And the biggest problem I'm seeing now, especially, you know, fully verbal teenagers, is they're not making the transition to work. And then I can think about the times I was out in the plants and I was working with people that were definitely autistic that owned metal shops and had patented equipment. Now, I think one of the places where I think a lot of people today will need to be helped in starting their own business is a lot more complicated today. This is something where you could set up an accounting service that people that have independent businesses could use that was reasonable in cost, because that's where a lot of people with autism need help is setting up a business and running a business part of a business.
So you recommend that people, advocates, start out by just doing work unrelated to advocacy.
Well, I'm not, what I'm saying is that they either could do the work first, I did the work first, or at least do the work along with the advocacy. Because I think they're going to be a better advocate if they can talk about, okay, this is how I got this job, this is how I'm keeping this job. I think that's going to help them to be a better advocate. I mean, they could do the two things at the same time. I was probably a good 10 years of work. Then the advocacy started one little meeting at a time with a lady named Warner Jean King that was doing occupational therapy with sensory integration with autistic kids, in the 70s. And I do talk to some of her groups. And then I got invited to do some talks in the early 80s with the continuing education group. And then I was approached by a small press to do one of my first book, Emergence Labeled Autistic.
So what do you hope that listeners with disabilities would get out of listening to this episode?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Sorry. What do you hope that listeners with disabilities would take away from this episode?
Well, I think we need to be, getting out and doing things. And I know one of the things, it's a problem, I've talked to a lot of people about it, is if they're getting disability payments, they do too much work and then they lose their health insurance. And I think that's a huge issue because that's going to motivate not working because you can't afford to lose your health insurance. Now it's different in different states, and some states are really bad. I don't think I'm going to name any states, and some states are a whole lot better in terms of the amount of money that a person with a, that's on a Social Security, I may put the wrong names for some of this stuff, payment. But I remember talking to one man and he goes, it's kind of a trap. That's his words, not mine. And what I think they need to be doing is no matter what, keep the health insurance. I had a blind roommate when I was in graduate school, and Gloria and I were discussing this, and she says, I could give up the SSI payment if I could just keep the health insurance. That was in the 70s. Now I'm still hearing that today.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a real problem. Some states will let you earn quite a bit of money, and there's other states, I was just in one of them, you can't earn anything and you lose your health insurance. I think that's something advocates need to work on changing. I think it's just terrible.
So what do you hope that listeners who have yet to become neurodiverse would take away from this episode?
Well, there's all kinds of disabilities, and they need very different kinds of accommodations. And what I think we need to have the emphasis on what people can do. And I have another book called Navigating Autism I did with Deborah Moore. And she talks about label locking, where parents and teachers get so much into the label, they don't think the person can do anything. Let's say somebody's using a wheelchair. Well, then they can assume they can't do anything. Well, they can do a lot of things. Programming computers. The one that, if they were mathematically minded, they could do that. It'd be something they could do and do really well. Man that I have an old-fashioned telephone answering service. I don't know, about 20 years ago when it broke, I called them, and the owner says, I can't roll over the cables. And that's when I realized he was in a wheelchair. He was running that answering service business. I only knew about it because he told me he couldn't roll over a cable.
Wow.
And he owned a business. You see, this is the kind of thing that I talked to another guy who was a beautiful photographer, absolutely beautiful, in a wheelchair. And he had one of these power assist chairs where it works like a manual chair, but it's a power assist. And I'm going, you ought to be going to flower shows and taking pictures of flowers. All you got to do is show your portfolio, you're hired. ADA Accessible Convention Center, that'd be really cool. Oh, those pictures of flowers were so beautiful. That's selling the work. And people will pay a bunch of money for that.
So going back to the movie, particularly the end, where I got really choked up. First of all, we shared three things. My voice didn't come in until age seven. My first language was a version of ASL.
Okay.
And we both didn't get through high school algebra. I took it three times.
No, I couldn't. I don't know if I could graduate from high school today because I can't do algebra. And fortunately, college math wasn't algebra, but I can't do algebra. And I think on some of this, they need to back off. I have talked to students that want to become a veterinary nurse. It's a two-year community college degree. They're on their second and third algebra class.
Wow.
And you don't need algebra to be a veterinary nurse. Now, I think one of the reasons why algebra is being pushed is the more mathematical minds think that you need algebra for logical thinking. And I was horrified when I was doing the book signing for visual thinking just last year. We did one of the talks at a school, and I sat down with the principal for an hour, and he didn't know what my kind of thinking was. He didn't know it existed. And I said, you'd like the air conditioning to work in this building, wouldn't you? Yeah, gets hot in the summer. You're going to need people like me that can't do algebra.
Well,
but I've often thought about, what if I waved a magic wand and I'm now 18 years old. I've just failed high school, couldn't graduate because of algebra, but they let me keep my knowledge. What would I do? I'd go in the back door of a business, and I know exactly how to do it. I saw people in the meat industry get a job on the line. 15 years later, they were project manager for the new cooler edition. Oh, I'd head over to the Amazon warehouse, or if I could get to it, the new chip factory they're building, because I have a goal. I'm going to design the next one. And that career path is completely doable. I've seen people do it, and I know how big corporations work. I just go right in the back door. So, and a lot of people don't realize the back door exists, but half of all good jobs are back door.
So the ending of the movie, when you took your roommate to view what you made at the end, you said, I don't know what's coming next, meaning what's on the other side of this life, but I want to leave a legacy behind, feel like I made a difference.
Well, I'd like to do something as a positive difference. We've got too many people today that go out and do something really bad that's making a negative difference.
And so my question is, do you feel you have done that through your life?
Well, I have, my mind doesn't think, verbal thinkers, like regular verbal thinkers, tend to be very top down. They'll talk about accommodations or, you know, an inclusive classroom or whatever, and it's very, very vague. You know, I think in specifics. Just the other day, I was walking to the parking garage and ran into a student who was on the autistic spectrum. I made her day. Okay, I think I made a difference in her life. I think I've helped inspire her, and we did a picture in the parking garage. That was a good trip to the parking garage. And, you know, these are the kinds of things. Now I'm way past retirement time, and I want to help the next generation, show them that they can do it. One of the things that motivated me in the 70s, when I was working on the projects that were shown in the movie, and those are accurate, I wanted to prove I wasn't stupid. That was a very, very big motivation for me. A lot of people thought I was stupid and I wouldn't amount for anything.
And so what are you currently working on right now?
Well, I'm still teaching my class in livestock handling. I'm doing a lot of speaking engagements, a lot of Zoom calls. I'm also writing papers on livestock subjects. So I'm going to be working on writing a paper up on how I developed some animal welfare evaluation systems that we aim for students to read. There's very practical things. Too often, we have way too much theory and not enough practical. Let's go back to accommodations. Okay, we talked about the pilot's checklist. We talked about avoiding rapid multitasking. But some other accommodations might be sensory breaks. Another accommodation at work might be LED lighting that flickers. And that can be a problem for a segment of the autistic people. And so how do you deal with that if you can't get rid of it? Buy a lamp, put a bulb in it, probably be an LED, but find one that does not flicker and put it next to your desk, a real bright one. And if you can get the lights changed, great. But if you can't, you have to override those lights with a brighter light that doesn't flicker. You see, I like to give people these kind of practical things. There's noise canceling headsets. But the problem is, if you wear that all the time, your sound sensitivity will worsen. What you want to do is have it with you all the time. Try not to wear it all the time, but have it with you. That gives you control. And if you're working with kids, that let the kid turn on the vacuum cleaner or the hairdryer, something that really they don't like the sound. Because when they control that sound, they may be better able to tolerate it when they turn it on and off. These are the kind of tips I like to pass along. There's some individuals, when they go to read, they see the print jiggle on the page. Because of the problem with the circuits in the back of the brain that form the graphics files, here's a simple thing that sometimes works. Try printing the homework on light pastel papers. Like, for example, in my children's book, Calling All Minds, you can see there's some light blue paper on that. Pastel papers, like that light blue, light tan, a light gray. Try these different pastel papers, put in a copier. This works for some people. I like to pass on these very simple things, like the colored pastel paper, the thing to do with the LED lights, the pilot's checklist, simple things that you can do that can make a big difference.
So you just mentioned that one of the great motivators of your life was proving to others that you weren't stupid. And you've done that. You've become world renowned. How do you feel about what you've done with your life?
Well, right now I get asked how I feel about people coming up and recognizing me at the airport and stuff like that. And I feel it's a responsibility. I've always got to behave well. And I hope that I can inspire younger individuals to get up and do things. Because I found that some of the most interesting and fun things I ever did was sitting around with other people and we were figuring out how to build stuff. It was a lot of stress on those jobs because we had to make equipment that worked. But just figuring out how to build stuff. That's friends who shared interests. And I'm doing advocacy. But just yesterday, I went out to a feed yard. Nice, saw some really nice cattle there. And I sat on the feed bunk and I let the cows lick me. That was a good afternoon. I enjoyed that.
So you mentioned at the top of the interview that your mother and your aunt,
yes,
played a huge part in your life, in your upbringing. If they could see you now, or if you could tell them something, what would that be?
Well, my mother always was, she kind of had a good sense of how to push me to do things. She'd always give me choices. And we were limited on how much television we could watch. They wanted us to get outside and play around. And I can't emphasize enough, the importance of teachers and mentors. I just cannot emphasize that enough, how important that is. I just want to warn you that we are coming up against a hard stop in about 10 minutes.
Thank you. Well, I have really enjoyed this interview. I enjoyed meeting you, and I do hope that you would stay in touch and that I can interview you again at
Yeah,
some
we could do
point.
that. We could do that again. And I really liked what Stephen Hawking said about disability. And I'm sure everybody knows who Stephen Hawking is, a famous physicist. And he told the New York Times shortly before he died, concentrate on those things. Your disability does not prevent you from doing well. He could do math in his head super well and not very much else. But he did math. He did the thing that his disability didn't prevent him from doing well. And I really liked that when I found out that Stephen Hawking said that.
Well, Temple, thank you so much for your time and authenticity. And I have enjoyed your work, and I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Well, I'm going to be just keep on doing what I'm doing. Got my book here, Visual Thinking. If you want to figure out what kind of how you think and what might be good jobs for you, you can read this book. We also discussed Thinking in Pictures, my memoir from 26 years ago. Like we discussed earlier, I'm going to just say it now because the interpreters were not here. I discussed my experiences with medication. And I had some very favorable experiences that are described in detail in this book. And I just want to make sure that got into the part of the interview where you had the interpreters.
You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guest, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, subscribe, and share the podcasts. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2023.